from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made as we wrap up our Heroine at Home series. And I hope that you've had a chance all month long to absorb some of the coverage that Michelle Faust has been putting together for WXXI News. In our last hour, we spoke to family members of people addicted to heroin and opioid painkillers. And this hour, we wrap up the Heroine at Home series. While working on the series that we are recapping this hour, Michelle had a chance to speak to a number of people who are in programs to treat their addictions, and even more family members who are suffering in their own ways. And I think that's a good place to start this hour, Michelle.
That's right. I spoke to so many different family members, as you mentioned in the last hour, the people who either I was reaching out to for the coverage of this series or just called me themselves because it was a story that rang true for them, and tweets and emails and phone calls. One of the families that I spoke with, they were the parents of a 25-year-old who we're going to call Joe. We're calling the mother and father by their middle names, Elaine and Doug. Joe is writing his own story right now. He is serving time for credit card fraud. He committed that crime to get money for heroin. He started writing while he was in the hospital for a heroin-related infection. And on the tape that we'll be listening to right now, it's his father reading the story. And I just want to give a heads up to our listeners that there is some language that has to had to be cut out of this tape.
He was in the hospital, and he had already been going through this for a couple of years. And this is what he wrote. For the past few years, I've been constantly shuffled in and out of hospitals. The separate occasions in the ER, a blur. Its entrance turned into a revolving door. Each one of these brief stints in various hospitals across the U.S. feels like an eternity, but acts as a much-needed rest from the chaos of my everyday life, a chance to charge the batteries. The interesting, or uninteresting, thing about spending an extended period of time in the hospital is the different shapes and forms that boredom can take. It's like the feeling you get from different weather fronts moving through the country you live in, or the temperature difference you feel as you move from inside to outside. You can actually watch the boredom collect on different objects in the room, akin to the morning dew collecting on a leaf above your head, the water repeatedly condensing and forming a bead on the tip, and then slowly dropping onto the surface of your forehead while you try to sleep in the early hours of the morning. Drip, 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 driving you crazy. I hate being bored. I don't do bored well. Don't get me wrong. My life has been a complete show and can be labeled many names, but one thing it has not been, for the most part, is boring. The revolving front door spins faster and faster, sending me on a helicopter ride back in time through memory after memory. I suppose I should introduce myself. My name is Joe. I'm both the good guy and the bad guy. I'm a lover and a fighter, an athlete and a bum, a musician and a junkie. I'm a heroin addict submerged in addiction, yet I'm working hard at a program to attain sobriety. I'm a good and honest person, capable of gaining those who surround me's trust and friendship, but I'm also an extremely dark and manipulative person, capable, guilty of destroying relationships with lies and deceit. This is my story, a story that everyone seems to think is worth telling. I think he put the nail on the head when he said I'm both the good guy and the bad guy. And I mean, he doesn't want to do any of this. He's so trapped. He's just so trapped. He is, I think he's done with it. He doesn't want to do it. And yet he gets out and gets thrown in the middle of nowhere with nothing, and he can't not do it.
So what you hear in that tape, and part of the reason that we're highlighting that is I think you hear the pain of the father who has the compassion for his son and wants to see the good parts of his son and his struggle and what is he looking for as far as getting sober. You have the son who's acknowledging both the good parts of himself and the bad parts of himself, the struggle with boredom. When speaking to Joe's family, he had struggled with depression before before the addiction issues. So just several facets to the whole problem of disease within the individual and within the family.
What I found striking about the writing from Joe is the self-awareness of a heroin addict. So many of the stories that you have told and have been told through the series this month show that there is a self-awareness, that addicts understand that this is a terrible problem and that they are trying. But as the father says at the end, he gets out, he's on his own, and he can't not do it.
Well, you know, I mean, I wouldn't speak for every person in addiction. The people the people who I spoke with, most of those people were in recovery, in treatment in some way. And I think they would even say themselves that that recovery process and the 12-step program or whatever program they were in, they were learning a lot more about themselves. And that was giving them some space to be able to understand themselves.
Yeah,
better.
I wouldn't say there's no denial. Of course there's denial. There could be years of denial of a problem. But it is pretty remarkable that once that ball starts moving toward a willingness to get clean, the self-awareness is often right there.
So throughout this series, as our listeners may have heard, may have seen in some of our web stories and some of the extras, is just this growth of the problem of heroin throughout the state, throughout the country. We spoke to U.S. Attorney for Western New York, William Hochul, and he spoke to us about what law enforcement is seeing in terms of heroin on the streets. And he talks to us about what it cost to buy this drug and the low cost around heroin.
Our costs are generally the same that we've seen. We estimate that about $10 will get you a deck of heroin. A deck is typically the reference point for retail customers, and it equates to about 0.3 grams of heroin. There are some reports that it may be a bit less, but as a rule of thumb, the cost has been relatively the same in the time that we've been talking about. But as studies have shown from the seizures that we are accomplishing here in Western New York as well as elsewhere in New York, the potency is what really has changed over time. Typically, when I began as a federal prosecutor, we might see 10% purity. Today, it could be almost 40% purity. Combine this level of purity with some of the additives that the traffickers are using, and you have a very lethal brew that could be awaiting anybody who buys one of these decks or bags of heroin.
One of those additives that's were known is being seen, especially in the people who are dying of overdose, is the additive fentanyl.
That's exactly right, Michelle. This particular product, of course, has a pharmaceutical purpose behind it. It was originally given as a form of pain reliever in different medical clinics and hospitals. And like so many of the substances we see, it began with the best of intentions. Unfortunately, mad scientists working outside the United States and traffickers who sense the ability to make profits have started seizing on the description and the formula for fentanyl. They're making their own product in less than laboratory conditions. And then whether using it individually by itself or combining with heroin, it now is contributing to some of the overdoses that we're seeing across Western New York, it seems like every week.
How does it compare the use and abuse of heroin and the seizures of heroin in comparison to other drugs, say methamphetamine or marijuana, other drugs?
Well, I can tell you from the kinds of cases we're bringing here at the United States District Court level, our cases involving heroin are in the increase. It used to be that the cocaine and crack cocaine cases were the majority of our docket, but we're bringing cases like never before. As a matter of fact, in the middle of May, just several weeks ago, we had a major success where we took down 7 heroin traffickers that had tentacles not just here in the Rochester area, but spread all the way to the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania area. In that case, we seized over 3.5 pounds of heroin. By itself, that probably could have contaminated upwards of 10,000 people. But in addition to this bulk heroin, we also seized over 11,000 individual decks of heroin. Those again represented hits for a potential customer. So if you put those two together, perhaps 20,000 people could have either been contaminated, killed, or could have been customers of this particular trafficking ring. Fortunately, because of the actions of the law enforcement, and here in the Rochester area, we're blessed where all levels of law enforcement, from RPD up to our suburban departments and certainly our federal partners, thanks to all of their combined efforts, these traffickers are no longer in business.
That's U.S. Attorney for the Western District of New York, William Hochul, talking about heroin on the street and what they're seeing and what they're doing about it. We've been talking about how heroin cases locally have been on the rise, but let's put some numbers on it. In 2014, the Monroe County Medical Examiner's Office investigated nearly 100 deaths related to heroin overdose, and that is a 70% increase from the previous year.
Nationwide, the spike in deaths related to opioid drugs has a lot of people talking about naloxone. And naloxone is the overdose antidote. And I spoke to a mother who wants to see more average New Yorkers trained in how to use this medication.
I think a lot of times if you hear the term heroin addict, you think of somebody derelict living on the streets. And that's not really accurate anymore. I raised a happy little boy.
Joan Hessenauer's son, Jimmy Hissey, died of a heroin overdose in May of 2014. Jimmy struggled with addiction for more than 10 years. Since his death, Hessenauer created a website to help other families dealing with addiction.
There's kids who have gone over and served our country that come back and then overdose. There's kids in high school, and they aren't bad kids. They're athletes. They're smart kids. I think if you don't think it could happen to you, then you're not really being realistic.
That's why Hessenauer wants more people to be trained in how to administer naloxone, also known by the brand name Narcan. The medication can reverse an opioid overdose, whether from heroin or a prescription painkiller. Although it was too late to save her son, Hessenauer got naloxone training at the University of Rochester Medical Center's recovery program run by Dr. Gloria Bashevitz. URMC is one of more than 270 sites in the state that offer the service.
When you think about it, it's one of the few really perfect, almost perfect, antidotes that we have. It, you know, it gets the dangerous opioids off the opiate receptors, and it has very, very few side effects. So it's really a wonderful medication that saves lives.
New York state lawmakers agree and have made the drug subsidized and readily available to lay people. The state has the largest number of programs in the country, and Good Samaritan laws protect a person from drug prosecution if they help someone during an overdose. Daniel Raymond is the policy director for the Harm Reduction Coalition, a national advocacy group. He sees New York as one of the states taking the lead in the proliferation of the medication.
The question is no longer whether naloxone is part of the solution, but how to make it as widely available as possible.
The state's most recent budget dedicated $272,000 to training school nurses in how to administer the overdose treatment. The Harm Reduction Coalition is also working with the state prison system to get former inmates trained in naloxone. Could it be paying off? A report last month by the advocacy group Trust for America's Health implies it is. The report ranks New York's rate of overdose deaths eighth lowest in the nation and links that low rate to access to naloxone. Law enforcement and first responders across the state carry naloxone. Captain Michael Fowler of the Monroe County Sheriff's Office testified in front of a state Senate task force that his officers reversed six overdoses within the first months of a naloxone program they began in December 2014.
Well, it's certainly positive for that family, for that individual, and for those first responders, but it's not the solution. What we're finding more and more is that those persons that are addicted, those users, will continue to use. And they will seek a higher high.
For Hessenauer, who's still actively grieving the loss of her son, naloxone can give hope to other families struggling with addiction.
I don't think it's a cure-all, you know, in reality it's a Band-Aid, but if you can give somebody the chance to make a different decision, and I think it helps a parent or a friend or a spouse to feel less helpless, because it's a very helpless feeling. to love someone who's addicted to heroin.
Michelle Faust, WXXI News.
Now, naloxone can only work if it's administered in time, shortly after someone goes into an overdose. The state's pushing for more, just about everyone, to get trained in the administration of the drug. And they say that after you administer the drug, which comes in the form of a nasal spray, you have to stay with the person until the paramedics arrive. And some people will need multiple doses. When people are trained in our community, they're given a kit that includes two doses in case a person needs to be given more than once before the paramedics come. New York State Senate Task Force on Heroin Opioid Addiction, they've toured many cities in this spring throughout the state, and this May they stopped in Rochester. When I was at that task force meeting, I met a young man, John LaCroix. He survived a heroin overdose because he was administered naloxone, and he just did not come out unscathed. He came out with some major issues. He had some strokes since then, and just a lot of problems now with his speaking and his cognition and even walking. LaCroix wanted people to know what happens when you abuse opioids, and that's why he came to the task force meeting. And a word to our listeners in this tape, LaCroix has some trouble with his speech.
This is what happens when people use heroin.
How long did you use heroin?
2 years.
What happened with your heroin use?
I overdosed.
You overdosed. And what, did they have to use naloxone to bring you back?
Yeah. 3 times.
Did you overdose 3 times or they needed 3 doses?
No, they needed 3 doses.
So we can see that he said, I'm here because I want the senators and other people to know what happens when you use opioids, when you abuse them. He, like very many of the other people that I spoke to, started his addiction by using opioid painkillers.
Well, let's shift the conversation now and ask a question. What do you suspect is the leading cause of accidental death and injury in New York State? Automobile accidents used to top the list. But that's not the case now. New York is one of 35 states where drug overdose is the leading cause of accidental death and injury.
New York State is working on changing that. In our next report, we focus on how physicians are integral to treating addiction. And yet the country still has a shortage of doctors that are trained in that specialty. Many doctors get very little training in addiction.
There's such a need. You know, I mean, I remember down in Florida going into the detoxes. Everyone was there for opioid addiction.
Seth Skinner is 28 years old. He moved to Rochester almost 4 years ago. It was another couple years before he got into treatment for opiate addiction.
And there's such this need for treatment. I think it was hard for the providers to kind of, and the doctors and the therapists to try and fulfill that need.
The American Society of Addiction Medicine reports there are over 3,000 board-certified addiction medicine physicians. Experts say that's not enough to help the nearly 25 million Americans over age 12 with addiction. The University at Buffalo is one of 27 schools in the country with an addiction medicine fellowship program for doctors who want to go into the specialty. Dr. Richard Blondell oversees the UB program and works with the American Board of Addiction Medicine to develop new national programs. He says most doctors receive only hours of education about addiction in med school.
There are more doctors out there prescribing heavy doses of narcotics than there are out there trying to help people get off of them.
Blondell explains that addiction is a chronic disease, like diabetes, that requires ongoing medical supervision. Dr. Stuart Gitlow, the immediate past president of ASAM, says few family practitioners think to send their patients with addictions on to another doctor.
But it's very unlikely in most parts of the country that they would think to send you to the addiction specialist physician. And there's a difference, right? If you go see a counselor, well, they can do some things, but not everything.
One thing a counselor can't do is prescribe medication. Some patients trying to give up abuse of heroin or other opioids may be put on methadone, buprenorphine, or naltrexone. Seth Skinner gets buprenorphine. known by the brand name Suboxone. He says he once thought the medication was the answer.
I found out that is not true. Suboxone is a tool. It's been a great tool for me to stay sober. But it's been one of the tools that I've used to stay sober.
His doctor, Timothy Wiegand, director of toxicology at the University of Rochester Medical Center, says it takes a team to help his patients stay off heroin.
The physician is like the quarterback in this setting, working with a lot of other really important individuals, the counselors that are working, running the groups in the individual sessions, the social workers, the care managers.
Stigma and misunderstanding of addiction, even among medical professionals, says Wiegand, contributes to the lack of treatment. If a diabetic came into the emergency department with a crisis related to their disease, they'd be set up with follow-up treatment. That's not the regular course of action when someone comes in overdosing from heroin.
They don't leave with the program in place. They don't leave with the medications they need to help stabilize the disease of addiction. They don't leave with a physician appointment, typically, for an addiction medicine specialist. And that's a huge disparity between these two medical conditions.
Some hospitals are now moving to link patients treated in emergency with a long-term treatment program. But even with growth in the field, treating the 2.4 million Americans addicted to opioids remains a challenge. Skinner is feeling optimistic about his recovery, but knows how hard it can be.
It's a combination of things. It really is. It's not just one thing. There's no miracle drug or miracle answer. And everyone's different. Yeah.
Michelle Faust, WXXI News.
Now, we spoke with Skinner there, and he says, you know, it's not for everyone. I know that there was some controversy over Suboxone. In other communities, Suboxone is a little bit, some doctors are more apprehensive to use it. Here, anyone can be on Suboxone who needs it if the doctor deems it necessary, but there are places where it is a little bit more difficult to come by. There's some controversy around it, but there are many different types of treatment, and doctors say that it's not everyone should be on necessarily an opioid replacement, but it is one option that may be good for some people depending on their treatment. And the idea is that everyone should have a doctor overseeing their treatment. They look at opioid addiction as a chronic illness, an addiction as a chronic illness that needs to be treated like any other chronic illness. Some people take some offense to that idea of addiction as a chronic illness. I got some mail about someone who was not happy with the term, making the comparison to diabetes. That comparison came from at least six of the doctors that I interviewed while I was working on that. And, whether it's something that everyone is comfortable making that comparison or not, I will say that many people who work in addiction and as a specialty, they see it as a chronic illness, and that's how they're hoping more people will look at it.
All right, we're going to get a short break, and in our next half hour, Michelle, what are some of the stories we're going to hear in the next half hour?
Well, as we spoke in the last hour, mental health parity, we'll talk about what that means and what it means as far as access to treatment and paying for treatment in New York State.
It's all coming up next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, are you a closet preservationist? We will meet the Yups, the young urban preservationists who are trying to recruit new members. We'll tell you how you can join them and why they think we all should be trying to preserve historic buildings and parts of our community. Then second hour, it's our monthly science roundtable, the science of photonics. Join us Monday on Connections.
Hello, I'm Ken Glazer, honorary co-chair for WXXI's Go Public campaign. Each day, I turn to WXXI for news programming that engages and challenges me. It's important that we keep local, independent journalism strong in Rochester. Please join me in support of the Go Public campaign. Make a gift online at wxxi.org/gopublic. And thank you for your support.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, joined by my colleague Michelle Faust, as we continue our look the month-long series Heroin at Home, and you may have recently started to hear the term mental health parity. It refers to federal and state requirements for insurers to cover mental health and addiction treatment as they would any other medical condition, Michelle.
Now, the problem, Evan, is that insurers have not always complied with these laws. Here in New York State, lawmakers recently took some action intended to take hurdles from insurance out of the long path of recovery from addiction.
You don't die from heroin detox. You don't. You feel like you're going to, but you don't die.
In 2012, Joe was a heavy heroin user, so his mother Elaine called her insurer and asked if he'd be covered if he went into an inpatient detox program. She says her company told her it would be fine under the plan, but after only a few days, the detox center called. Joe was about to be kicked out because her insurer had refused to pay.
He wasn't going to die, and so they didn't have to pay. And the first of all, what a scam. You know, you're not going to die, so you're not going to die now.
We've agreed to call Elaine and her husband Doug by their middle names, and we'll call their son Joe. The couple agonized over the thought of Joe being put out. He was on the West Coast, and he was suffering complications from a severe lung condition.
I remember, I was still going through it. I did not want to move around. I wasn't eating. I was throwing up.
We spoke to Joe over the phone. He's now serving time for credit card theft, a crime that he committed to get money for heroin.
Looks like we might have to let you go, yada, yada, yada. My parents were saying, well, we'll pay for it out of pocket, which would have been outrageous. It would have been an outrageous amount of money.
Joe's parents ended up paying nearly $10,000 out of pocket for his short stay in detox. The specifics of this family's case with the insurance company are unique, but the experience rings true for thousands of families in New York State. They sought treatment for a loved one, only to be told it wasn't covered by their insurance. New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has gone after five of the state's largest insurers over the past year for illegally denying similar claims contrary to state and federal mental health parity laws. Settlements with the AG's office are reinforced by state laws that went into effect in April. Lawmakers cracked down on insurance practices like fail-first provisions that would only cover the cost of inpatient treatment after patients had first failed at an outpatient program.
You have to fall off the wagon and get back to taking drugs. Or we're not going to give you a more advanced form of care. So we've eliminated that and other requirements like that in our settlement. So more New Yorkers are getting health care, getting the addiction treatment they need.
That doesn't mean everyone automatically ends up in an inpatient center. Today's state law requires insurers to look at multiple factors to determine what level of care is appropriate for each patient. Then all those factors are reviewed and approved by the New York State Office of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse Services, or OASIS. Robert Kent is the general counsel for OASIS. He says before lawmakers cracked down, health insurance denials pushed people into state-funded programs.
You know, effectively, the funding we were providing to these programs, which is primarily intended to cover the care for people with no insurance, was in some level subsidizing the cost of care for people with insurance because they were being denied access to the care.
Under the newest laws, a patient can stay in treatment while they appeal being denied coverage. For Doug and Elaine back in 2012, that process took way too long.
About this, it's dragging me down way too far. Like,
we're already struggling with what's going on with our son and worried about him surviving and then having to fight the insurance company.
But Kent from OASIS encourages New Yorkers to go through with an appeal.
If you appeal, then there's opportunity for us, for the state Department of Financial Services, to intervene and try to get decisions reversed.
Michelle Faust, WXXI News.
Now, Elaine and Doug, who we featured in that story, they paid nearly $10,000 out of pocket. And they said as middle-class people, it was very tough. They said if they were wealthy enough, they would have been able to spend a lot more on their son to get him into a more intensive program.
I mean, there were all these programs, if we were rich,
right,
that we could have put him in for months at a time that were nice facilities with, you know.
Yep, and then follow-up and halfway housing and segueing into other kids. Like these, there are some things like that that
so
are very well put together.
So if you're a millionaire, you can do it.
Now, we spoke to so many different people who were family members or people who are in their own recovery programs. We spoke to Shannon. She's 31 years old. She's in an outpatient recovery program. And she's under the care of Dr. Timothy Wiegand, Director of Toxicology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. I thought her story was very interesting about her story of recovery.
So this one, you know, I did an outpatient at Huther Doyle. And the program was helpful. You know, I think it's important to just learn compliance in the beginning. You know, like, it wasn't enjoyable. I didn't love it, obviously. It's not fun, but it taught me to just show up and do what I'm supposed to do, you know, because in this lifestyle, we take the whole time we're out, you know, we're just leeches on the world. So it just taught me to, like, do what I was told to do, you know, and try to, like, give back a little bit and surrender, if you will. So, you know, I think it's all pieces of the puzzle. If I had one part of it without the rest, it wouldn't work. You know, for me, the Suboxone, Dr. Wiegand, Huther Doyle, and my 12-step program all together work. I mean, it's like literally a full-time job. It's exhausting. You know what I mean? It's not, no one would choose to do all the parts of it. You know, it's a pretty hefty list, but if you don't do it, you end up being this zombie, you know, or dead. And so even though it's exhausting, I choose to do it, you know, and at the end of the day, it feels good. I'm at a point now where, like, in a 12-step program that I work, I now work with other people coming in now, and it's pretty cool to see. Sometimes you get lucky and you get to, I have one right now, she's 19, where she reminds me of how I was, you know, at 19. And you get to help them avoid those extra years of pain, you know, so it's pretty cool. Yeah.
One thing that struck me about Shannon, she was very matter-of-fact, very proud of her recovery and very just to the point of what was going on with her. She got very emotional when she spoke about this 19-year-old that she's working with in the 12-step program. That's the only time when I saw tears roll down her face. And I asked her why. And she said, you know, just the idea that you could prevent someone from all those years of suffering. She's 31. She went through, you know, what would be about 10 more years of addiction and all the problems that went along with that, then she's hoping this person won't be going through, including prostitution for the drug.
Well, let's turn our attention to prescribing now. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that right now there is the equivalent of one bottle of prescription painkillers for every adult American in this country.
And meanwhile, 46 people a day die from an overdose from the same painkillers. Here's how New York State is addressing the problem of overprescribing.
So much of today's heroin problem is due, in my judgment, to yesterday's overprescribing of opiate substances.
Leading experts in medicine and law enforcement agree with the U.S. Attorney for Western New York, William Hochul, on this.
Suboxone or hydrocodone is synthetic heroin. Doctors had the right to prescribe them for legitimate medical purpose, but unfortunately, in some cases, profit motives clouded their judgment, and they became drug dealers in lab coats.
A University at Buffalo study found 3 in 4 people in treatment for heroin used prescription opioids first. Shannon, 31 years old, became addicted through drugs from the family medicine cabinet.
I started OxyContins when I was 14, became physically dependent by the time I was 15, and switched to heroin by the time I was 17. Probably. So yeah, it's been a long time.
In an effort to disrupt the pathway to addiction, state lawmakers created iStop, or the Internet System for Tracking Overprescribing. The laws went into effect in 2013 and require doctors to register and track prescriptions before writing a new script for a patient. The Department of Health says the measures help decrease the total number of opioid prescriptions by nearly 9%. Sam Quinones is a former L.A. Times reporter who's covered the growth in heroin abuse nationwide. In his book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, Quinones explains the 90s saw an increase in prescriptions for opioid painkillers. He says most doctors prescribed in good faith, believing marketing from Purdue Pharma that described OxyContin as less addictive.
The way this starts is basically because a lot of doctors buy into the idea that these are we no longer run a risk of addicting our patients if we use them to treat pain. And, you know, in some cases, in a lot of cases, they were right. People did. People could use these without much risk. The problem is there were a whole bunch of people who they couldn't prescribe them to risk-free, and these people got addicted, and there was a huge amount of collateral damage.
Dr. Richard Blondell oversees the University at Buffalo Addiction Medicine Program. He says the best approach is to prevent people from becoming addicted in the first place by educating physicians and communities about addiction. He confirms the clear connection between painkillers and heroin.
So if we let the healthcare system create drug addicts and then discharge them from the healthcare system, the dealers in the illicit marketplace will be right there.
New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman sees iStop as part of the solution. He wants the federal government to go further to curtail the proliferation of prescription opioids.
And also the federal government spends hundreds of billions of dollars paying for people's health care, so they buy the oxycodone, and then they have, our tax dollars have to cover the treatment, so we get hit on both ends.
For a national perspective, a 2013 report by the Health and Human Services Inspector General found more than 700 general care physicians with questionable prescribing practices. Shannon has been in successful treatment for her long-term addiction for 2 years. She wishes more people realize the risks associated with narcotic pain medication.
You start with not supervising your kids in the medicine cabinet, you know, and leaving stuff around. They start stealing Vicodin, and eventually it's going to lead to heroin. It's just, I mean, not every case ends up like that, but most people that I know that are addicted to heroin, that's how they started. You know, it was like rifling through their parents' medicine cabinet.
All provisions of the iStop laws, including the delayed requirement for all prescriptions to go electronic, will go into effect March 27th, 2016. Michelle Faust, WXXI News.
I think this is very interesting. You know, I've had back and forth people sending me things, especially on social media, about, okay, well, how addictive really is heroin, opioid drugs? Well, there definitely is a physical chemical dependency that some people will develop. But there are many people who are prescribed and don't necessarily become addicted. But the problem here is that those people end up with an over, you know, if they get a 60 or a 90 day supply of some sort of opioid and that stays in the medicine cabinet, that can then be either stolen from their home, be taken from by someone in the home, a child or even, you know, anyone of any age who might want to experiment with that. And, you know, what the doctors were saying to me, several of the doctors said to me, they estimate about 10% of people will develop some sort of an addictive disorder. And you think one of the examples that was given was when people go to college, a lot of people experiment with binge drinking in college, but only a small number of those people will go on to become alcoholics in the future.
Yep.
So that's the number that a lot of the addiction specialists are throwing around, about 10%. But they say that having too much of these things, even alcohol, having too much of any kind of addictive substance around will push those 10% of those people off that cliff of addiction.
Again, it goes back to that there's substance use, substance abuse, and substance dependency.
Exactly.
And even if it's 1 in 10, we're talking about thousands of people in this country every single year. So we'll see in the future if there's more of a movement to reduce opioid prescription in general. But one of the pieces of advice we kept hearing this month is, if you're prescribed opioids, ask how much and why, and maybe ask for a small supply. You might not always get it, but that might be a safer bet for everybody. We got a chance now to hear from the Attorney General of New York State, Michelle Faust.
Yeah, that's right. Our news director, Randy Gorbin, spoke to New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, and he goes more into detail about many of the provisions in state law, some of the more recent work that the state has been doing with some of his leadership to curb this epidemic of addiction and with heroin and opioids.
Well, it's been one of our highest priorities since I got into office when I... Before I even became Attorney General in early 2011, I was aware of the problem of the explosion of prescription opioid abuse, which is it's a huge problem in and of itself, but it's also a way that people who would never go to a heroin dealer actually get hooked on essentially the same chemicals, and a lot of folks, when they, you know, then turn to heroin because it's cheaper. And we realized that there were ways to not just go after more bad guys, and we've continued traditional law enforcement efforts with our organized crime task force. We busted, I think, 24 major drug trafficking rings, recovered guns, 2,000 pounds of illegal drugs. And so we have not abandoned traditional law enforcement, but I quickly realized that we had to figure out a better way to solve the problem. So we came up with an idea for an internet tracking system for prescription opioids. And I'm happy to say that we developed it, organized a coalition of people in law enforcement and healthcare and families who had lost loved ones to prescription drug abuse, and got the legislature to enact the, what we call the iStop program, the internet system for tracking overprescribing, which is unique in the country. We're the only state where every pharmacist and every doctor is hooked into a real-time database, and they have to consult it before either writing a prescription or filling a prescription. So the overwhelming majority of doctors and pharmacists are professionals who want to help people. So if they see you have three oxycodone prescriptions, they will try and counsel you and not fill it. And we could spot the number of folks who were really just script writers who wrote a lot of prescriptions very quickly. The New York State Department of Health estimated that doctor shopping, that is people who had more than one prescription for the same drug, dropped after the enactment of the iStop program. In 8 months, it dropped by 75%, which is extraordinarily rapid response. And we know from some of the pharmaceutical companies, they are shipping less of these products to New York than they did before. The next thing we recognized was that we had one of the major problems, obviously, is when you have someone who is overdosing, how do you give them treatment if you can't get them to a hospital right away? And there was the development of a new form of a drug called naloxone, a new delivery mechanism that made it possible for police officers and others out in the field to essentially, it's a nasal spray, to use a nasal spray that stops overdoses. It reverses the effects of a heroin overdose, and it saves lives. And we just started that program up in April of last year, and we offered to buy naloxone kits with funds we get from forfeitures of drug gangs, and we've been supplying police agencies all over New York State with the kits. I think more than 27,000 naloxone kits, and it has saved more than 100 lives. So again, we're looking at the problem and trying to come up with ways other than the traditional law enforcement mechanisms to deal with it. So we have police officers supplied with this. You can save people's lives and get them into treatment. The iStop program shuts down the prescription opioid entryway to heroin abuse. And we've also became concerned that a lot of people whose health insurance should have covered treatment for drug abuse really weren't getting the treatment that they needed. So we took a very aggressive posture, I think unique among the states, in going after health insurance companies that did not provide parity between what they consider mental health coverage with physical health. In 2006, New York State passed a law requiring that insurers provide mental health coverage at least equal to coverage provided for other health conditions, and then the federal Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act was passed in 2008. So we've gone into court to enforce those laws, and we've entered into five major agreements with huge insurers, Cigna, MVP, Healthcare, Emblem Health, and Excellus, which is the largest plan in upstate New York, huge plan in Rochester. And the settlements have required them to cover drug abuse treatment and other behavioral health conditions the same way they cover any other type of illness. The settlements give people a right to appeal. There are 3,300 members whose requests for substance abuse treatment were denied that now can reopen those cases. And going forward, they're going to have to provide a lot more services for people. The old system actually prevented people from getting treatment because someone who has, say it was life was saved when they were overdosing by an injection of naloxone, the person clearly had almost died and should have been taken to an inpatient facility. The old system required that people try outpatient substance abuse providers and fail at them before qualifying for inpatient rehabilitation treatment. That's essentially saying that you have to get back, you have to fall off the wagon and get back to taking drugs, or we're not going to give you a more advanced form of care. So we've eliminated that and other requirements like that in our settlement. So more New Yorkers are getting health care, getting the addiction treatment they need. Fewer New Yorkers are getting prescription opioids. More lives are being saved with the COP program. And we're now working with some of our neighboring states to try and get them to develop similar internet tracking systems so we can stop the problem of cross-border doctor shopping. And,
sure.
And that's something that I think will be a major project of ours over the next couple of years.
In terms of mental health parity laws, Mr. Schneiderman, do you think that the insurers now are on board? Do they have now a good faith effort, do you think, to try to really cover addiction? Or is it still kind of like, obviously you're going to monitor them, but do they embrace this idea now of mental health parity, do you think?
I think it is come a long way, and I think that we're looking at a shift in awareness about mental health issues. There's sort of been a stigma associated with mental health. A lot of people didn't want to speak up about it, didn't want to complain about it. If someone in their family had a mental health condition, there just was a reluctance to bring it up. Well, we've brought it up very aggressively, and more people are speaking up. It's a big problem in America's criminal justice system because such a huge portion of the population of our prisons and jails are people whose major problem is some sort of mental health issue. So this has become much more of an open subject for public debate. Actually, it's something that, and I've never heard a presidential candidate talk about this, it's something that Hillary Clinton talks about a lot, talks about mental health parity and the stigma of mental illness. And I just have never heard it raised at that level, but it's something that people now are more open about. It's something that is being raised with insurance companies. I think within insurance companies, they are becoming more sensitive to these issues. So I look forward to the trend is moving our way. I think public consciousness is shifting. I think the attitudes and awarenesses inside the insurance industry are changing. And I think this is going to continue to expand the rights of people to mental health coverage and particularly substance abuse treatments. There's a lot of very effective treatment modalities out there that just still aren't available to many people who could use them, and that's something that that we have to deal with as a state and as a society.
Sure, and just finally, you mentioned, you know, it sounds like you think the iStop program, you know, has been working, but do you think the state needs even greater oversight of doctors who inappropriately prescribe, you know, various opiate types of medications?
Well, no, we have, I mean, you can't. It's very hard in New York State to overprescribe nowadays, and there are some doctors who are pain specialists, and the data from iStop goes to the State Department of Health. They know if you're a pain specialist and you're giving out a lot of oxycodone, okay. But we used to have people who are eye, ear, nose, and throat doctors giving out a lot of oxycodone. So that's not so much of a problem in New York. Our biggest challenge really is that the federal government hasn't been stepped up to the plate on this. I mean, they continue to approve very powerful opioids. They have this iStop really should be a federal program because it's you want to stop people from getting prescriptions in different states. And also, the federal government spends hundreds of billions of dollars paying for people's health care. So they buy the oxycodone, and then our tax dollars have to cover the treatment. So we get hit on both ends. So I'm very, very determined to not just to get other states to connect up to us, to really take this in a much more aggressive way to the folks in Washington to try and get them to set up iStop as a national program. It will save lots of money. It will save lots of lives. We know it works. We've got the data to show it works. And that's something that's one of my most important projects over the next couple of years.
What's coming down the line right now, and it's in our last budget, the state put quite a bit of money into getting school nurses trained in how to use naloxone, and they should be doing that training this month. So starting the next school year, all school nurses in New York State are supposed to be trained in how to use naloxone to step in if something were to happen on school grounds.
Let me just ask you a very human question here, because you have worked on these stories all month long, and no one is saying that you're asking for anybody's sympathy here, because you're covering people whose stories are tough, and they're the ones struggling and fighting and trying to get clean and trying to get sober. But has it taken a toll on you at all? I mean, you've reported on so many different things in your career, But this has been very heavy this month, hasn't it?
It has been a very heavy month. I'll just leave it at that. Generally, you know, my philosophy as a reporter is we hear lots of stories and we hear from big newsmakers and we hear from people like Schneiderman all the time. I think it's very important, much more important, to tell stories that you don't necessarily hear on a day-to-day basis for whatever reason. And those are the kind of stories that I want to bring to the light. Whether a person agrees with the person who's speaking or not, or has any sympathy for them or not, that's on them. But at the end of the day, I think it's important that we hear stories that usually get hidden because no one is listening because they don't have a microphone in front of their face all the time.
And as we heard last hour from a mom whose son is dealing with addiction, when you hear people finally talking about it, that sparked more people to contact us, to contact you, to call this program, to email you. And we heard from them all month long. And maybe there's something cathartic. Sometimes there's a question about where to find resources. And I am I'm proud of the work that you and WXXI have done to help them. But let's end looking forward. What are you looking for next when it comes to battling heroin? What's on the horizon that could change, or you know, what is sort of out there that you're watching for next year?
Well, I mean, we're looking at many different things, but at the end of the day, I think we highlight most of those things in our series. At the end of the day, one thing that we can say is that New York State really is a little bit ahead of a lot of different states in the way that they approach naloxone distribution, treatment, mental health parity, in a way that you're not seeing necessarily in many other places. Is there a 100% silver bullet solution? Not at all. But there are many approaches that the state is at least willing to try, whereas some other states are a little bit slower at going in that direction.
I think of all the parents you introduced us to this month, and I take their stories to heart, and I hope that if our listening audience, if you know someone who is addicted, if someone in your family, if it's you, that you know that there are people and voices out there and resources out there, and you don't have to be silent. Michelle Faust, tremendous work this month. Where, one more time, for those to get the coverage and more information and the resources, where do they go?
WXXINews.org and click on Heroin at Home.
I'm proud of you for the work that you've done this
month. Thank you.
It's really important work. And I appreciate the fact that WXXI News has leveraged the support for you to do that work. So thanks for listening these 2 hours to my colleague Michelle Faust and John Andrus, our engineer behind the glass. Thank you, John, for the great work today. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday on member-supported public radio.